Today is October 4th, 2021, and I'm happy I have a number of students in front of me, and I'm happy to see everyone on the screen. I just want to mention we're experimenting. Again, I'm in a terrible position because I'm talui bidei acherim. I'm dependent upon others, and Yomo is trying to run it off the YU system. If a problem should develop, give us a minute or two. How long will it take you? 30 seconds, he almost says. He'll switch it to his mechanism, his device. All right. Today it's a sad moment. I want to recall the memory of Reb Moshe David Tendler. To me, it's like the end of the yeshiva I knew. As I mentioned yesterday, his picture hangs in my office as part of the 1953 faculty, and he was the last surviving member of that picture. But what people don't realize is that Reb Moshe David Tendler's association with the yeshiva is more than 100 years. 1921, it was a quite a large smicha class. Until 21, b'sach hakol, there were maybe 10, 11 graduates of the yeshiva who got smicha. When I say graduates, it's a little misleading because most of these individuals came to Reitz on the Lower East Side, Talmidei Chachamim from Europe. So I'm given a Rupesha Talmidei Chachamim. And in 21, you had more graduates than in all the years before. And one of the graduates was Reb Yitzchak Tendler, Rabbi Isaac Tendler. That was Rabbi Moshe David Tendler's father. And to look at pictures of Reb Yitzchak, I didn't know him personally, but I knew many people who did know him, including my own family, because my kid brother married the daughter of a longtime Rosh Yeshiva in RJJ. And as you know, his father taught in RJJ. What I was told years ago, I haven't done research, I can't say I can vouch for this scholarly, but what I was told years ago is that his father, tall, good-looking, strong rabbi of a shul on the Lower East Side, never took a salary from RJJ. And people looked at him, and he never took a salary. He was independently wealthy. He was in real estate on the Lower East Side. And people always ask, why didn't he move away? You say, wealthy, everyone, my parents moved from Harlem to the Bronx. If you're wealthy, you moved out of the Lower East Side. You moved to Brooklyn, you moved to Harlem, Harlem to the Bronx, etc. But he loved the East Side. See, there were people who couldn't leave that environment. If there was any Yiddishkeit in America, it was on the Lower East Side. He had a wonderful family, many children. One son, you all know, a younger brother of Reb Moshe David, ran in the high school. He was the dorm father, Rebbe, in Talmudic Academy of Baltimore, and very beloved. The stories about him are legendary. I think there's actually an art scroll book about him. He had a sister. They were Mechut and Rabbi Pear. Rabbi Pear's son married into the Tendler family, and you can go on and on. Reb Moshe David, if there ever was a poster boy for what Yeshiva University tried to achieve, and I underlearned the word try, but if there ever was a poster boy, it was Reb Moshe David Tendler. Here was a man of first-rate Talmud Chacham, a son-in-law of Reb Moshe Feinstein, not a small matter. And on the other hand, biology professor, at one time he was, if I recall in my time, he was either dean or assistant dean of the college, and he represented all that YU stood for. I have to add, on a personal level, and we spoke about this yesterday with Ida Neudel, she was quite a right-winger, and quite upset with the reality of the situation in Israel. I need not tell you, you go through our recent history and our compromises, the land we gave up, the price we have paid, and people were involved voting for the compromises, right-wingers, religious people. She could never make her peace with it. I can tell you that Rav Moshe Dovid Tendler was a right-winger, but he already knew how to handle life. He was rabbi of a shul. People today think in terms of Muncie, that it's a bastion of Haredi, Torah, Judaism in the United States. Muncie was nothing. Spring Valley had the Kollel from Torah Vadas. We spoke about it. And then Spring Valley, slowly but surely, people went beyond Spring Valley, crossed the border into Muncie, and Reb Moshe Dovid Tendler was, if not mistaken, one of the earliest so-called YU Rabbanim there, if not the earliest, and his shul was a powerhouse. I also remember that when he started the shul, he did not take a salary. The Balabatan gave him X number of thousands of dollars to give out to tzedakah. That was the arrangement, that he had a charity fund that he could administer, and the Balabatim paid into that charity fund. They didn't want to have a rabbi for nothing, but he did not take a salary. I don't know what happened later. I imagine later when it consumed more of his time and he could do less teaching, perhaps he did take a salary. But you have no idea what this man accomplished in life. Rav, Talmid Chacham, Posek, rabbi of a communal synagogue, and at that point in the 60s into the 70s, the 80s, Muncie was a bastion of YU people, and it had, if we talk about a Eruvim in America, one of the most early Eruvim that had Reb Moshe Feinstein's approval. And remember, you heard my shurim, Reb Moshe was a machmir when it came to Erev. Reb Moshe was a machmir. And it had Reb Moshe Dovid, it had Reb Moshe Feinstein's approval. And once you had approval of an Erev in Spring Valley, Muncie, obviously then it spread, Kew Gardens Hills, and ultimately, even though Reb Moshe was not happy about it, it spread to Brooklyn. Today already you have on the west side, you have on, I understand, in the around Yeshiva in Washington Heights, there's an Erev today. But if you check it out historically, it all goes back to Reb Moshe Dovid Tendler and what he built in the Muncie area. When it came to Israel, and by the way, he has children here and their grandchildren, a good part of his family lives here. When it came to Israel, we were in the same camp. He was a real right-winger. And I noticed in Makor Rishon, they write about his death, and they stressed the fact that he went up the Har Habayit. I don't want to go into that now. We once spoke about it in class. I don't go up the Har Habayit. I don't go up simply, I'm a Talmud of the Rav, or the Rambam, or, you know, all right. I mean, some are saying the Ravid and the Rav Gorin. This is not top right with the Kedusha. But all right, I'm a little hesitant. The other reason I don't go up is simply at my age, the energy and the feet are more limited. So let me stick to what I did. But I always tell anyone when they ask me, I said, look, if you want to go up, just follow the psak of the Rabbanim who are matir and do what they tell you to do, to go to mikveh, etc. There are all kinds of rules and regulations. But I told people in America who argued with me that there is today a security factor, that with the rationale behind the Har HaBayit, if we show ownership, it leaves a message that we're here to stay, and I need not elaborate. On a personal level, I want to share with you one story. I was hesitant to share the story, but yesterday, I have to thank Yomo. He put it up right away, and I already was contacted from over the world on yesterday's Shia. And one of the people contacting me was from Toronto, a very wonderful, important person who's done wonders for the Mizrahi point of view, the religious Zionist point of view, also has children living here. And I was hesitant. He said, no, you got to tell the story. So I'll tell it and I apologize. In all my years of speaking, and I don't deny I have spoken basically all over the world, from Australia to South Africa to England to Canada, coast to coast in the United States, a good deal of Israel, etc., the army, I was from the army, I gave shurim in Syria, and I gave shurim yet in Africa when we still had Sinai. So this never happened to me anywhere except in Muncie. I don't know how many years ago, about 20 years ago, I'm speaking, big crowd, I was Scotland residents, and this was Sunday, and Sunday already people can drive, so you really had a big crowd, hundreds and hundreds of people. And all right, a Rebbe, I quote the Rav, I think I have it in, again, I don't know what I published or what I said in class, but the Rav, you remember the quote, and Rabbi Schachter also quotes this in one of his sperm. We were all ear and eye witnesses that the Rav finished the Yotzeit Shiur. He was exhausted, he fell back, and a rabbi from Brooklyn says, comes right over to him. I don't know who the Rav was, some hush of a Rav from Brooklyn. I mean, he had chutzpah, and the Rav let him get away with it. And he says to the Rav, Rabbi Rav Soloveitchik, du bist a gresa aktor. You're a great actor. And without beating an eyelash, the Rav says to him, Avada bin chanakta tse, ledin in teire tse, gebin ibe dat men seinen aktor. Mit darf halten die Talmidim, ze sollen herren und verstehen. And the Rav told him right away, to teach Torah you have to be an actor, you have to motivate the students. So I don't have to tell you, I see a crowd of hundreds and hundreds, like an actor, I was in good form. Do you know what happened? In the middle of my talk, Moshe David's wife, Shifra Feinstein-Tendler, stands up and starts applauding. She stood up and started applauding. Everyone, do you know I was interrupted 6 or 7 times with applause? All right, I walked out of that. I didn't let it go to my head. I told people, said to me, wow. I said, listen, you know what's happening in Muncie? It began with Rabbi Tendler and then Rabbi Beryl Wine and YU, Chicago, Skokie, you know, broad influences. And then suddenly Hasidim came in and Litvashi Yeshiva came in. I said, the people finally heard so and spoke with a bit of a YU Mizrahi ideology. They were led to applaud. They're starving. It's like rain falling on parched land. So Rav Moshe David was very, very special. And he honored me. I don't recall if it's the time we went back together to the States. Twice YU brought me back. Pardon me for telling already these stories, but I think I've mentioned it when I went in Aliyah, it was epic making, you know, who heard of so leaving America back in 69 and they eulogized me. I don't have time, but I can tell you I was eulogized by important people giving Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi built the shoes, and then Dr. Velker made a farewell a luncheon for me. And Dr. Velkin gets up and he speaks and he ends off the talk. Dr. Rotkoff, you should know there will always be opposition for you at the yeshiva when you return. And that's what he said to me, more or less, if you return perhaps. So I got up, I was being honored by yeshiva. I was honored twice, but I don't know whether this was with the Rebbe or Dreetz, but it doesn't matter. And I got up, I started my speech. I said, Baruch Hashem, I'm not here to look for a job. I'm here to be honored for what I accomplished in the state of Israel. And Rav Moshe David Tendler, I spoke. So this was the time with the Rabbi Soloveitchik on the Rav's 25th Yahrzeit. I gave 11 different shiurim in 11 different locations for YU. Big crowds all over. And Rav Moshe David came to hear me, the talk I gave in YU. And I greatly appreciated it. He was there. I mean, he's like a Rebbe to me. Rav Heschel Schechter already is my contemporary. So he was there. Others were there. But Rav Moshe David, and I saw he had Hanar. He understood already. And he's told others, we speak the same language. So, Yehei Zichro Baruch. I wish I could say he lived a long life. But at my age already, early 90s, mid-90s is not long enough. If you would see what I have prepared to teach, you'll understand what I'm saying. But I very happily dedicate the shiur today in his memory. Okay, let me go on. Yoma, why do I have that white there blocking the faces of my wonderful students? What is that telling us?
It's just monitoring the
market. But it's working?
Yes.
That, Jack, you hear me? Okay, beautiful. It's working. Okay, I want to make one small correction when we're speaking about Reb Meir Kahana, and not a correction in fact, but just I quoted a letter from Manny Bahar, and I confused him with his brother. In other words, he wrote to me that his brother Danny, who's married to Esther Gross, they were both my students, and Manny said he was not my student, but he's married. He's married to my student, Evelyn Weissman. I remember her too, from Michlala, early years of my teaching here. I think it was 74. And he made the point, which is interesting, and I bounced it off Yomo, and I can tell you, Yomo, who knows so much, didn't know what I was talking about. Senator Henry Jackson. Do you remember that name? Scoop Jackson, Washington. Out on the east, the west coast. And Senator Jackson was one of the greatest friends that the Jewish people ever had. And he proposed his legislation was that Russia would not have fair nation status or favorite nation status unless they allowed the Jews to emigrate. And there was opposition, the establishment, you're going too far. I mean, imagine Jews were telling Jackson not to go ahead with this. And Kahana, and my sub-Talmud, Manny Bahar, was involved working for Jackson. And he says, Kahana, when Jackson came to New York to speak, Kahana was in the audience. And later, of course, Triple SJ and Birnbaum, everyone went on the bandwagon, and we owe Senator Jackson's memory a great debt of gratitude. It had a great impact on Russia, and ultimately, he is part of the reason the gates opened.
The Jackson-Vanik Amendment.
Right, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. One was a senator, and one was House of Representatives. Okay, now I want to move on, and I have to tell you, I had some Talmudim here from the new Talmudim from the Kollel before Sukkot. They have disappeared, but one of them told me, Barak Bad Beda, told me that his chavrut, I think it was running the book fair at YU, and outside YU students were picketing because they were selling Libby's two volumes on Meir. And I tell you, it's so hard to hear this. And tell me, if they were selling books on Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, anyone would be picketing? I mean, and these books, these are not books written by Meir trying to convince you to join with him. These are books written by Libby, who's a fabulous scholar, a trained scholar. She was a head of research in the library to help anyone who needed help to find material in their research at the Hebrew U for many decades. And this is Libby, who wrote a real scholarly two volumes on her husband. There's nothing to object to. You want to buy it, read it, fine. You don't want to buy it, don't buy it. But if you're interested in Meir and his life and how he functioned and what he believed in, okay. It's hard to comprehend the progressive liberal world. We'll come back to it next Sunday in the Halacha Shir. All right, now, I want to devote today, we scanned Meir's life, and again, I come back, his two great achievements, you can call one achievement Russian Jewry, the other achievement, his ability, the JDL. And I think what I said last week hit home. I can tell you that if you look on the websites, the Shomrim, whatever they called them in Borough Park, caught crooks on Yontif. And they had to announce that the vans, the police cars, were driven by Goyim again to let you know that it was non-Jewish police officers. They shouldn't be chayshesh that they're catching crooks with Jewish volunteers on Yontif. But all that goes back to Meir. And those were two great achievements. But there's more to Meir. And even in these achievements, I'll touch upon what bothered the establishment, underline the word establishment. And Meir had the ability, he raised problems. I don't know whether his solutions were perfect or practical, but he raised problems. And those problems exist until today. And I want to talk about Meir, what he did, why it rubbed the establishment, and what he thought about. There's no question that what I said about 1937, I believe it was, four or five members of his family being killed by Arabs on the way back to Tzfat after a wedding. There's no question that that had a big impact on Meir's thinking. On another level, and this I feel on a very personal level, his frustration in the rabbinate. Imagine you come into a new community, a Howard Beach, and you put a mechitza in on Thursday night, and by Sunday, in my work in Washington, at the exact days, it's either Sunday or Monday, they fire him. And this too, my brother once said to me, Meir was always self-centered, always secure, always said he was right. But an incident like that certainly made him more convinced you can't cooperate with the others. And this influenced his life. And sadly, from my point of view, we came in Aliyah. When I came in Aliyah, no one looked at me, no one said hello to me. He came in Aliyah, Begin and Gula Cohn offered him a safe seat on the Gachal ticket, Gush Kayut Liberalim, before the Likud. And he turned them down, that they're not solid, like Eden Udel. You follow, you've made compromises, all right? By definition, a politician has to make compromises. Rakepit is a big shot. He never left his desk, so he doesn't have to compromise. And I'm always hesitant to criticize my friends who are politicians because I understand what they're up against. I can afford to be perfect. No one is going to shoot me out of office. But all right, they have a problem. But this was Meir. Now, the JDL, I have to tell you, when they first began, they were appreciated by everyone, including Temple Emanuel. This is what Libby shows. She quotes the newspapers. There was a speaker at Temple Emanuel, and already they threatened to demonstrate against the Jews. And Meir came down, and they stood guard. No one could go near, no one could harm a Jew, no one could curse a Jew, no one could maledict a Jew. But I'll tell you, when it began, I would say any thinking Jew was happy with what Meir was doing. The problem begins when they begin to appear, I'm quoting, by the way, this is from Rakafet Aaron Chelik Dalid, where I published my two reviews on Libby Kahane's first two volumes. The problem begins when Meir's people began to appear with baseball bats and lead pipes. And you see, this is like the vigilantes in New York, they have brass knuckles. The Puerto Ricans had developed the vigilante group, which they learned from Meir, and they walked around with brass knuckles. You can understand already that the Reform Jew going to Temple Emanuel, the establishment, you see Jews, all right, it's one thing, they come to Israel, they see soldiers, they see guns. They have no idea how many guns are floating around in the civilian population. You see with the Arabs what's going on. Half those guns they robbed or stole or bought from Jewish sources. And the Jews, I say it's a miracle that we don't have more murders than we have. We've had already enough. A man gets mad at his wife, he pulls out a gun, boom, finished. Do you understand? A woman went to jail, she was just released, she served many years, she killed her husband. I would have set her free immediately. The way he treated her, you understand? It leads to violence, and if guns are available, then we have a miracle here that we have a very low level of violence. Halavai, it should be nothing. And the Arab population, I don't have to do, is a real problem when you talk in terms of over 1,000 Arabs have been killed in recent years by their own cousin, by their own brothers, not cousins. We're cousins, but the others are brothers. But this is where people started to turn against Meir. And I want to quote to you, I'm quoting Libby, gives you all the sources. Bert Zweiborn, all right, to you it's a name. To me, I taught his family. I don't know if they were from to begin with or the whole family came Balei Tshuva, but they were big supporters of Meir Kahana. And Bert Zweiborn, when they were criticized, Bert spoke in public, I quote him, "We are not vigilantes. We don't go out to apprehend anyone. We protect Jewish life and property. When someone attacks you, you fight back. That's the halacha. When someone comes to kill you, you have the right to defend yourself." And of course, halachically, he's 100% right. The question is how. And in Chutz Laretz, to walk around with lead pipes, or to walk around with brass knuckles, or to walk around with lead pipes, nunchucks. Baseball bats, what else do they have?
Nunchucks.
Nunchucks, right. That this is questionable. In the state of Israel, this is why I say all along, we can't take the law into our own hands. But you certainly have to put pressure on the politicians that let the police shoot. Don't wait until they come and shoot us. Look what happened with that poor soldier down south. There was a tremendous outcry, and the laws of opening fire, and this is a very delicate issue. I think I said it in class, but you have to understand, it's not that the politicians are rishayim. The politicians are looking at the total picture. And they're worried if you shoot and kill three Arabs in self-defense, there'll be a whole upcry. So better to look the other way, and obviously if you look the other way, you're going to sacrifice Jewish life and Jewish property. These are the delicate issues that we face. All right, I'm a right winger. I say the more we show strength, the more we will be respected. But this is Zweiborn defending Meir, and you have to think about it. This situation with Meir, right or wrong, ultimately gives birth to, I would say, so much graffiti. Lo aleinu, I'll tell you in Israel in a second, but you understand, people will either say Kahana Tzadak or Kahana Hayana Visheka. It's either Kahana's right or Kahana was a false prophet. And when we lived that terrible period of the Intifada here, where they're blowing up buses, and believe me, I lost so many people that I knew on buses. It's not something intangible. One bus blew up a block away from my house. We knew four people on that bus. Four people. One person was an Olah from Russia. She had come an Aliyah with two children, and a mother, a father, and the father became a Chabadnik here, and she couldn't handle it. They got divorced, and she worked, supported the two children. She was blown up on that bus, and here are two kids that were left totally orphaned. The father was remarried, had a whole new family. I guess he just couldn't handle bringing them in, or his second wife couldn't handle it. And they put the children, the mother had a sister, so she became the home for them, and my daughter became their legal guardian. They became part of our family. That boy, that wonderful boy who was left, later became a tremendous Ben Torah, graduate of Hesda, graduate of Machon Lev, and he married a girl. It's only in Israel. You don't have to read novels. He married a girl whose father was from Germany, ran away to South America to escape Hitler, became an ambassador for the State of Israel, lived a very good life, knew absolutely nothing of religion, and had no intention of getting married. And when he was maybe in his 40s, he met a beautiful Sephardic dark lady. He couldn't resist. He married her. She was related. When I sat with her, she would tell me, this Baba, that Baba, the biggest Moroccan yichis you could imagine. And this boy met their daughter in Bnei Akiva. And that was the wedding I told you about, where Malka said to me, put on a white shirt, you're going to have the first two brachot. Rav Steinholz is being Masada Kedushin, dressed like a mensch. So I put on a white shirt, and I come to the wedding, and there's Rav Steinholz wearing a blue shirt. And I had to take off a blue shirt to put on a white shirt. But that wedding I'll never forget, because my grandchildren sat there looking at Rav Steinholz like I would look at the Rav, like I would look at Moshe Feinstein. I still see the glow in their eyes. And by the way, that couple very happily married, four children later. But this is Israel. But after these events, there would be graffiti all over the place. Meir Tzedak. Meir Tzedak. Then you'd see the left wing would go crazy. Navi Sheker, Navi Sheker. Now, with Russian Jewry, I have to say here is Meir took the bull by the horn. And it hurts to see all the books coming out. I hope what I spoke about yesterday, Museum of Freedom, if something will come out of it, I don't know. The person who contacted me, I asked him, come to Shiel, let me meet you. But I don't see him in front of me, not yesterday, not today. But if something comes out of it, I hope they'll be honest. I've read Feingold's book. I mean, I don't want to go into detail now. But when you read these various volumes, time and again, they barely mention Meir Kahana. He was the first one to put it on the agenda. It's not that he put it on, not just he put it on the agenda. All that happens afterwards, Jacob Birnbaum, Triple SJ. And Triple SJ was very important because they didn't take orders from the Mossad, from Nativ, from the State of Israel. I don't want to go into detail now, but I can tell you they were not the favorite characters with the people in the Mossad that I was working under. They didn't take orders, they were independent, they were students, some of them were hard-headed, but all that goes back to Meir Kahana. And Triple SJ gives birth to all the formal organizations, the National Council of Soviet Jewry, the New York Council of Soviet Jewry, the Washington Council for Soviet Jewry, the Philadelphia Council for Soviet Jewry, the Los Angeles Council, and all of them were active. They took orders, they worked within the establishment. But it all goes back to Meir. It was like falling stones. You start one stone rolling down the mountain, and by the time you come to the bottom, there are hundreds and hundreds. And that Meir deserves all the credit. Now, Meir, who grew up, and this comes back to my opening lecture last year, Meir grew up like Schleimler Kalbach, but even more than Schleimler, and like the Rebbetzin. He grew up his formative years with the Holocaust. And when you look back at the Holocaust, it's what I said yesterday, you can't escape it. We in America did nothing. We didn't have self-confidence. We were overwhelmed by Roosevelt. You may not remember this, but I grew up in a home. My father had a picture of Roosevelt on the wall. The Jews worshipped the ground that Roosevelt walked on. It's hard to comprehend what we're talking about. Eleanor Roosevelt was a great person, and there's no question she had no anti-Semitism within her. On the other hand, I don't want to tell you how he treated her and how he died and his mistress, etc., etc. A great ethical, moral human being. He would not qualify for an award for a practical life observing Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. Plain and simple. I don't say he was as bad as Kennedy or Clinton All right, we've had already presidents, I don't want to go into it, but they're not exactly role models that we as good Torah people can advocate. But we didn't do a thing in World War II. All right, I got to give credit, Reb Lezer Silva, Gevad Hatzala, Ben Hecht, there were people who worked, Peter Bergson, but they were, these people, I would use the word, were desecrated by the establishment. I'm using a strong word, but I think it's proper. They were desecrated. Hotheads, America, State Department, the President. And in one of his talks at Brooklyn College, Mayer, I'm now quoting him, this way he's trying to get people active for Soviet Jewry. We had, I'm quoting Mayer word by word, we had it in our hands to save over 1 million Jews at Auschwitz, but the United States could not bomb the rail lines because of technical difficulties. It was Jewish reaction which was wrong. Nowhere was there raised the voice of nonviolent civil disobedience. So what if they had gotten arrested? You can survive an arrest, believe me. And they write, laughter resounded through the hall at this remark. And what Mayer was saying, all right, had we gone out, had we yelled, had we shouted, how many times Rabbi Riskin became famous, chained to the fence, Rabbi Haskell Lookstein, was arrested, his father, everyone laughed, they said, boy, his father must be turning over in his grave now. Could you imagine Rabbi Lookstein, Joseph Lookstein, the proper Isai, dignity, pomp, etc. And here his son is arrested. But they became famous, they moved mountains, they moved senators, they moved congressmen, they moved governors, people spoke, people understood what's happening. So you do get arrested. Mayer was arrested, all right, he winds up in jail ultimately. But you survive, it's not the end of the world. And I think I told you, I have a Talmud who was one of Mayer's bodyguards. The BMT began, a whole group of fellas. They were wild guys, that much I'll tell you. Oh boy, wild, wild to the second power. And these guys were Mayer's bodyguards. And they told me, they got into the paddy wagon, they arrested 12, 15, whatever, and Mayer started saying Divrei Torah, all right? They were booked, the schmuck, they had a record, they were let out. No one sat in jail. Afterwards, there were some serious matters where people did sit in jail, but non-violent demonstrations, and Mayer was absolutely right, and an inspiration. The problem begins when you go on beyond the letter of the law. There's one thing, non-violent demonstrations. We have that in Israel. In my humble opinion, we have too much leeway with demonstrations. Anyone who lives in the center, you live in Rehovot, but anyone who lives in the center of Jerusalem didn't sleep any Saturday night for about 3 years already. What went on, and these are older people, and they would plead. Imagine an American person who came in Aliyah, has children, grandchildren here, brought millions of dollars into the country, would speak to one of these young progressive schnooks, and they'd laugh in his face, laugh in her face. No derech eretz, not for age. You laugh in a woman's face? How do you laugh in a mother's face, a grandmother's face? You understand what a woman is? It's the heart of the world. We're here because of the women, plain and simple. And fine demonstrations. The problem is when you get violent. And here you come to the story, January 26, 1972, they threw an incendiary bomb into the office of Sal Hurak. Sal Hurak was a Jew who was involved in entertainment, bringing in, arranging singers and dance groups, and ultimately brought the Bolshoi into America. And they were furious with him. You're bringing in the Bolshoi, you're giving credit to Russia, you're giving money to Russia, you're giving hard currency to Russia. There was a tremendous outcry against Sal Hurak by the Kahana group, the Triple SJ as well. But ultimately an incendiary bomb was thrown, and a 27-year-old secretary Iris Konis was killed. Konis may very well mean she came from a family of Kohanim, K-O-N-E-S, and she died of smoke inhalation. And this sort of, I would say, is the apex of Meir. From this point on, it's downhill. People were frightened, people were turned off, particularly as far as JDL, what are your limits? Nowadays, when you have the Shomrim in Borough Park, in Flatbush, wherever you have them, they work with the police. Their powers are limited. They're not going to carry weapons. They have to call the police right away. Their powers are limited. In the State of Israel, when I came in Aliyah, there was the local civil defense.
Mishmar Ezrachi,
local civil defense. It was a lot of people either past army age who already were finished with the army, they hit 49 and they were moved into civil defense, or they were volunteers, they were people who were never in the army, Olim Chadashim. And I remember they worked with the police hand in hand. Today, you have a bigger police force. Also, the Mishmar Gavul has been extended. So there's no more the Mishmar Ezrachi. As far as I know, I've never seen it. I remember used to see it all over Yerushalayim at the Kotel. Yeah, what are you saying, Mark?
Some of us BMT boys.
You volunteered. You patrolled at night. Right, exactly, exactly. That was the civil defense. I remember it vividly.
Emun Karba.
But it's within legal representation and restriction. The problem here was that it went too far. And many people say that at this point, it was the apex of Kahana. From this point in America, he started going down. And this is why he switched to Israel. This is the theory that in his own mind already, he was so upset. I mean, killing a Jewish lady, killing anyone, killing a human being. And ultimately, he moves on to Israel, as we will see. Now, I want to just tell you one little story and show you one picture. It may be the most interesting picture, or one of the most interesting pictures I ever took. With the camera, I did take some pictures over the years. People ask me, if you wouldn't be a Rebbe, a Rabbi, or what would you be? I said, I'd be a photographer. And, you know, you hear about Meir, you hear about the ADL and about Russian Jewry. But you know when we really learned his importance? Our final trip to Russia for the Mossad, I was there afterwards, 1989. So we meet a refusnik in Leningrad. His name, Naftali Balyapsky. I don't know where he is today. I don't know if he's alive. I don't know if he came in Aliyah. I mean, again, you meet them. It's a fleeting moment. And so many years later, I cannot tell you where he's at. Maybe by some miracle, someone's listening who knows him and can fill us in. And he came to our classes in Leningrad. And he came with his most valuable possession. You know what his most valuable possession was? A placard of Meir Kahana from the election campaigns when they gave out these placards to vote for mayor. And that's what he's holding. Yomo, did you see this picture? That's what he's holding in his pocket, sticking out. The most valuable possession, he told me, that he has, the picture of Meir Kahana. So I don't have to tell you that made a tremendous impression on Amalka and myself. It's a year before he's assassinated. But, you know, we said to each other, you know, we didn't realize how great Meir's influence was. I had another incident which also opened my eyes, and I share it with you. A very interesting little incident. When Malka and I came in Aliyah, I have to be honest, we never thought we'd see America again. We were two poor kids. If I would tell you, our total assets were $13,500, which we had from selling our home in Maplewood, which was a parsonage, but the Balabatim were very careful. They said, you're paying the mortgage, it's your money. It was a parsonage to avoid taxes, but perfectly legal. And when it was sold, so he had $13,500. The rest had been mortgaged that, you know, had to go back to the bank to pay off, etc. Fine. And with that money, we bought our apartment. We got a mortgage from the government to say, you know, the usual Olei Chadash story, although we had a certain twist, which I don't want to go into now, but suffice it to say, the money was not linked, and no one would ever dream how much the Israeli currency, which is a lira at that time, would go down in value. It was about 6 months they gave out non-linked mortgages. Then from that point on, everything is linked, and we were part of those that they ultimately pleaded with us, pay up what you owe, because it's costing more postage to send you the bill on the mortgage than what you're giving us for the money you owe. So it was a miracle from God. God was kind to us. But we were really, I have to be honest, you don't know what it's like to go through life. And Shabbat, you didn't know if you had money for food. I'd go to Machon Gold. I had a standing arrangement with Machon Gold, and that's why I got to know Nechama Leibovitz so well, because she said to me, if you're going to be Machon Gold for Shabbos, you tell me in advance, I'm coming too. And she could walk over. She lived a few blocks away. And those were difficult, difficult years. So I never thought I'd see America again. Really, I have to be honest with you. We came, that's it. No Yankees, no New York Times, no ice cream. You don't know what life was like then. You couldn't get, Charlie, in your time, did you have it? You couldn't get ice cream during the winter? Remember, they would look at you. So you know what I'm talking about. You came 2 years after us. They look at you, throw you out head first. Krembo, zema shochlim. So then what happened was I finished basic training, and I had established myself as a teacher with the, I was, you know, I think my reputation was better, more with Israelis than Americans at that time. I was teaching in Michlalar, and oh, the Mizrahi latched on to me. And before you know it, in 77, they sent me back as a shaluach to speak at the RCA convention, to speak in a number of shuls, had a whole schedule in America. It was very fascinating. And I went, my first Shabbat there, I went and stayed with my parents in Pelham Parkway. I didn't grow up, I never lived in Pelham Parkway, but after we left the home, got married, went into the rabbinate, my parents later moved from the East Bronx to Pelham Parkway. So I spent the Shabbat in Pelham Parkway with my parents. On Friday, I went to the bank. I don't know if I was depositing money, taking out money, whatever it was. I had a small account there. And it's in Pelham Parkway. I'm standing in line in the bank. And two elderly Jewish ladies are standing in back of me. Obviously Holocaust survivors. And I hear them talking one to the other. I'm repeating word by word. Oy, was hat meyer the guy in Seretz Yisrael? Min darf im haben da? Ich freise, wie kann ich gehen auf dem Gas? Min darf haben meyer? And I couldn't believe my ears. Why did Meir go in Aliyah? We need him here. We're afraid to walk out the streets. He protected us. They're referring to the JDL. I couldn't believe what I heard. Boy, I had a new understanding of Meir. Now, let's come to Israel, and I want to touch upon Israel, spend a little time on it, and time on the problems he raised. And here, it's very fascinating. When it came to America, Meir had very little confidence in the future. Whether he's right or wrong, it's open to debate. Remember, Meir functioned in America the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. He went back and forth. But I would say the 70s are the apex of its functioning in America. After the Six-Day War until the mid-70s, let's say. And he had little hope for the future. Well, today, approximately 50 years later, what has happened in America? And here, I don't know. We can be pro, we can be negative. On one hand, who would ever dream that the President of the United States would have grandchildren who were Shomrei Torah Mitzvot? Just think. 3 million American Jews don't have that. Trump has it. And I got to tell you, I have eyewitnesses, students of mine, who davened with the president's daughter, Jared's wife, and they, Ivanka, and they swore to me, Rebbe, she's a Shomeret Mitzvah. There was, they showed, they're eating in a treif restaurant. Well, it turns out that in the Lichtenstein crowd, that era, KJ, Rabbi Lichtenstein's, some of his congregants, they taka go into a treif restaurant, they order fish, and they double wrap it in silver foil and heat it up. It's no different than on an airline. You get on a treif airline, you get kosher food, how's it heated up? It's double wrapped, right or wrong, you're told. If it's cracked open, you can't eat it, but if it's sealed, double wrapped. So we all are samach on these heterim. It turned out, I can tell you the inside story, it's not for publication, of course. One of the Av Beit Din of the conversion is, we grew up together. And I told him, why did you get involved? He told me, he called them in and they explained, and Rabbi Lichtenstein came with them and said, now, Kehila, they eat. Now, sometimes she was photographed in dresses that were not kol kach tsanua. So this opens a whole Pandora's box. What is sneer? Does sneer have set forms that are totally objective, or is it subjective? And I can tell you, Eidat Nemana, that I saw in the Kehila Tatat Yeshurin Kehila, the frumest ladies from the frumest families went with sleeves like this. Charlie, can you? Am I right or wrong? What do you remember? Yeah, I'm talking when I knew them, I'm talking 60 years ago, 70 years ago. Right? No, their pictures, Art Scroll brushes up the pictures to... there's a whole... it's a whole panosa today for people. So what are these people? These are people, Gedolei Israel, wives, daughters, and good women. Don't misunderstand me, not rebelling. But, all right, there's no question that dress has a subjective factor, not just objective. No question about it. I mean, I said, certainly for the Litvakin, Reb Moshe's Jew, but there are Hashulchan, famous Hashulchan, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Maybe Hasidim would disagree. Fine, a Galitziana can disagree with me, Nungarisha can disagree with me, I'll accept it. But there's a good case you can make. So the Kushner crowd said that in KJ, this is the way our women dress when they go to a fancy affair, a wedding, a restaurant. All right, believe me, I'm not justifying it. And if you know my wife and my daughters and my granddaughters-in-law, Baruch Hashem, I have nothing to be ashamed of on this level. But I'm just explaining that she really is a Shomeret Mitzvah, all right? She's a product of the KJ community. So obviously, she's going to be dressed and as people in that community, etc. You can be very positive, or you can be very negative. When it comes to being negative, you know, the assimilation, the intermarriage, the concept of pluralism, what does it lead to? Who is left? And any of us who come from families that, as my family in America, more than 120 years, my wife's family, 150, my wife has great-great-grandparents buried in Queens in Mount Hebron Cemetery. And 150 years later, what's left? All right, my wife's family, I have to tell you, a good deal is left in the state of Israel, with their hundreds and hundreds of direct descendants from her family, most of them, 98% Shomrei Torah mitzvot. I mean, something beautiful. The Sohn family, if you recognize the name, all right, we're a branch of the family, etc. My family, outside of my brothers, myself, I don't know of anyone else that even knows what an Aleph Bet is, plain and simple. We have cousins, don't have children, you can't bring them into a terrible world. So, all right, you can debate whether Kahana was right, he was totally pessimistic. But what's interesting is when it comes to Israel, there's no debate. The problems he raised are so real, so tangible. Now, Meir Kahana, in a 1971 Jewish press article, raised a very simple question. Why do they need me in Israel? Why do we need a JDL in Israel? We have a police force there. We have Mishmar Gvul. We have a government. Everyone is Jewish here. You have a fire station a few blocks from here in Givat Mordechai. It's the only fire station in the world that built its own shul. There's a shul in the on the premises that they built. It's been written up. Mishpacha had a whole article on them. Others, I had a grandson who volunteered there. Two-thirds of the people working there are total Shomer Shabbos. The others are all Mesoratim. But what do we need? What do we need a JDL? So I want you to listen. This is Meir speaking. People ask, it's a Jewish press article, what purpose is there for JDL in Israel? Are there troubled neighborhoods? Is there anti-Semitism? The gullet, the diaspora, has bred in the Jew inferiority complexes, if I'm pronouncing it right, physical fear and mental abnormalities. It is totally possible to be a sabra, a genuinely free soul, and nevertheless be beset with all the complexities and problems of a gullet Jew. What must concern us is the sabra who ideologically proclaims himself an Israeli first and a Jew second. When the son of the mayor of Jerusalem writes a book and candidly states his Israelicism over his Jewishness as he sits next to his non-Jewish wife, we are faced with a serious problem. Now, let me give you the background. I couldn't believe this paragraph when I read it, because I suffer until today. I have, unfortunately, an event memory, not an image memory. If you know what I'm speaking about, I write about it in my work on the Rav. I remember it like yes. I couldn't get over that Meir Kahana. I'll tell you what it's talking about. 1968, television began in Israel. BG was opposed to television. He said, we are the people of the book. People will stop reading books. All right, Ben-Gurion, give him credit. He had a good attitude on that level. Of course, what type of books did he mean? But you couldn't stop progress. TV began in Zeke. We came 69. It was very, very primitive. One channel, black and white, and it went off the air at 10:30. They would tell you, go to sleep now. I mean, it was so primitive, you have no idea. But it was the only place you could get news. And it's not like today. I haven't looked at television in years and years. Whenever I want news, Yomo will tell you in the morning, I look at a Ritsheva, I look at Yeshiva World News. Baruch Hashem, I'm up to date. Once in a while I look at the New York Post. I love them. They're so anti-Trump. It's terrific. But all their news is such schmutz. It's beyond words what people are raised on. They hunt the world for schmutz to put into their news. Beyond words. I grew up in the New York Post. You remember the Bronx Home News? That's before your time. The Bronx Home News merged with the New York Post. And that was our paper. Later, I became sophisticated. I read the New York Times, but today, who wants to look? My wife reads the Times. That keeps her going. She has a whole subscription, Baruch Hashem. So, on the Israeli TV in the early 70s, they're talking about Teddy Kollek's son. Teddy Kollek, mayor of Jerusalem. People told us in 69, until Kollek became mayor, there was nothing here. He built the city. He built the museum. They said the day the museum was opened, the whole city went up in status. It was a little shik-yingle town. Wow, what he did, Teddy Kollek. Teddy Kollek. He knew nothing about religion, that much I can testify, but all right, he was an Amoritz. But he raised children here. His son appears on television sitting next to his non-Jewish wife. She didn't even convert, didn't even go through any process. And he says, I'm an Israeli, not a Jew. Okay? Tell me, isn't this the problem we have today? Just think for a moment what we're up against. Do you realize in the chinuch klali, mamlachti, natati, there is no exposure to any Judaism whatsoever. They came up with a new word, hadata, right? Coined a new word, approved by the Vad HaLashon, hadata, that you put up a tefillin stand, you're trying to influence others to put on tefillin, you're like a missionary. Didn't they want to outlaw it in Tel Aviv? Wasn't that on the platform of merits? All right, this is a real problem. Meir has touched upon, if I can quote Uri Zohar, who's really the quintessential Baal Tshuva of our Israeli generation. He's my age, and his life story is fascinating. It's not a simple story. He was very successful. His movies still show. He asked the Shaila if he's allowed to take the royalties on movies he did with, sex and wine and the drunkenness and drugs, etc. And they paskin, yes. What he did, but now he's a Baal Tshuva. But I'll tell you what's amazing in his story. I've dealt with Shilas, and what I've experienced in life is beyond comprehension. One individual, but I've experienced thousands and thousands of lives. Do you know how many marriages broke up over the man becomes a Baal Tshuva, or the woman and the other part doesn't, the spouse doesn't? Do you know how many marriages broke up? Do you know that in Israel today, there's a whole organization that deals with these problems, helping couples to keep together where one is religious and one isn't. And they have tremendous success stories. And you have endless stories like that. And Uri Zohar, no kid, he was already in his 30s, becomes a Baal Tshuva, and his wife, I mean, she married a wild guy. She married a movie star. She married a guy who knew how to drink, who knew how to take drugs. And suddenly he becomes a semi-charedi Baal Tshuva. What do you want out of her? Do you know that she went along with him? More than that, he had children already, at least two at the time, three at the time, were older, had cognizance. Kid already at 5, 6 has a mind of his own, or certainly a teenager. The children became tzaddikim. His kid who was born after they became frum was the least frum of all the kids. I mean, frum, Baruch Hashem, but his father said, not exactly what I want, but Baruch Hashem puts on tefillin, davens every day, learns Torah, observes Shabbat. He was more open. That kid would have fit in to this classroom, you understand? And Uri Zohar got up and said, I grew up in Israel, I was educated in Israel. I had a wonderful education, except the most precious gift that I was born with, they took away from me. My Judaism, my heritage. Uri Zohar, So you see, this problem, Mayor here, boy, do I remember that interview with Teddy Kolexa. Oh, my gosh. Forget it, it may have been Amos Kolek. You can look up the name. He wrote a book, and I don't know where he is today. This is 50 years ago. Unbelievable. Now, we've come a long way. You see, there's one thing to recognize a problem. It's another not to be depressed, not to let it get you down. How do we solve it? How do we solve it? So I have to tell you, so much is happening that is fabulous today. In Tel Aviv, they're advertising for people to come to live in Tel Aviv. They help you find an apartment. They help you find work. They integrate you. It's called, anyone know? Rosh Yehudi. They have a shul, they have outreach, they have classes. Do you see what happened this year in Tel Aviv on Yom Kippur? I saw the picture. Couldn't believe it. They put up a mechitza in Dizengoff Center, Dizengoff Square. For Ne'ilah, there were thousands of people, men and women, davening. They had the most fabulous personalities. How? You didn't see it? It's all over the internet. Go to Yeshiva World News or go to Arutz 7. Type in Dizengoff Yom Kippur. The people responded. People have Jewish souls. Everyone studied with the Malach. Did you ever ask yourself the Gemara Nida? What kind of, what's it, Taflamet? What kind of Gemara is this? The Malach teaches you and then he pinches you. Forget it. If you're going to forget it, why teach? So I heard from the Rav, and it's the only pshat. That Gemara's fam tells us there's something inborn in us that we can live up and accept Torah, belev v'nefesh. And this is the whole Baal Tshuva movement. It comes as a result of that Malach. We have to give credit to the Malach. He pinched us. There's a reason why. Excuse me. There's a reason why. If we would know Kol HaTorah Kula, we'd never go to school, we'd never have ambition. It's like a kid, Mark Wiener was born, his father gave him $10 million when he turned 18. Right or wrong, Mark? No, when you got $10 million invested and Elliot, you're living off the interest, you're not going to do a darn thing with your life. I know kids like that. I told you, I had friends always yelled at me, you're not serious about money. I let anyone rob my books, rob my novel, whatever you want. Get royalties. I'm the happiest guy alive. They want to read, want to hear. No, but you need money. All right, Baruch Hashem. All my children make more money in a week than I make in a month. Some make more in a month than I make in a year. You understand what I'm saying? Because they had a struggle. And the grandchildren know, they've been raised on this ethic. They know some of these kids that come from wealthy homes, they say to me, whenever we visit our friends, their father is in the kitchen, he doesn't work. I said, all right, because when their wives turn 21 or something, every month they automatically had $10,000. Why do you have to work? But this is... When all is said and done, what's going on in Israel today, we can be very happy with a lot of good. And it's more than just a lot of good. I can't do this type of work. Mark can't do this type of work. We're Americans. We don't know the mentality. We can work with Anglos. But you talk about the Rosh Yehudi, they know how to reach out to the Israelis. And they had the leading people there. Sivan Rahav was one of the speakers. Rabbi Lau Sr. was there. Oh, what they didn't have in Dizengoff. And it played well. The publicity was overwhelming. And they interviewed women who had never, who knows if they were in a shul before. And they said they felt very comfortable being among women. There's no sexual tension. They understood what a mechitza is about. You understand this? So the problem that Mayer raised is absolutely correct, but we don't have to be depressed. We have to deal with it. We have to be positive. And I have to give credit. An entire world grew up here. Took 100 years. But just think for a minute. The Haredi world, the Hasidic world, I can't say Vishnitz, Bells, Ger are the same as they were in Europe, but they knew what they were coming from, and they've made some adjustments. Panovich, Mir, Slabotka, etc., the Litvashi Yeshiva, they knew where they were coming from, they made some adjustments. But in the religious Zionist world, we had to begin from Ephes. It's not where we're coming from. It's where we're going. It's taking everything that came before us and putting it into Israeli context. And it took 100 years. Rav Kook began. Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria. These are great people. And take a look where we're at today. Has the yeshiva, Yeshiva Gevohot, outreach, Makor Rishon, the Svarim, the Psakim, the Psak, the Batei Dinim, the Dayanim, and it's all in Israeli context. And you got to remember, we're rubbing off on the Haredi world as well. All right, this issue hangs fire, it's in the press, it's in the Knesset. There was a whole the Jerusalem Post with their stupid articles. This week already they had an article, throw the Haredim into jail for not going into the army, forced them, coerced them. Articles being written in the Jerusalem Post. I couldn't believe my eyes. I already saw it in Haaretz. We have too many children. Too many children. Okay? I take my family, my brother's family, have hundreds of direct descendants. Too many Jewish children after Hitler? This is what Haaretz, this is what the Post is complaining about? These are real problems. Mayer is correct. I don't want to minimize the problem, but positive. We have to react. We have to respond. And Baruch Hashem, if we could see a Yom Kippur like that in Dizengoff Center, we're on the road. We're doing something right. Okay. Now, Meir was a very charismatic individual. And let me quote, when Meir was assassinated, Irene Klass, the wife of the publisher of the Jewish Press, wrote an article in the Jewish Press, "I Remember Meir." And listen to this description. "I remember the first time he came to us 12 years ago. He was slim, even in those days, and handsome. But it was not just the physical beauty of his face that caught your eye and held it. There was a certain brooding quality about his eyes, as though he carried the weight of the world on his shoulders. If ever a human being felt the pain and anguish of his brothers, it was Meir Kahana. This feeling, which one Jew is supposed to have for another, was to lead him into avenues even he could not have foreseen." And I have to tell you, this is a perfect description of the Meir I knew in Bnei Akiva. This is a perfect description of who Meir was. Good looking, a good speaker. Interestingly, he stuttered, but when he spoke, he never stuttered. They say that about the Rav too. People explain to me this is part of genius, but when he spoke, he never stuttered. But the concern, the dark eyes, the brooding, the feeling. This is what I told you yesterday. As I grew older, I became very disappointed that so many Jews don't think the way I do. How do we have to think? We're not just individuals. We're part of the Jewish people. And yet there's a whole world out there, self-centered. And you can be a Shomer Mitzvot, but self-centered. You see Jews, survivors, Holocaust, children, grandchildren, money, five towns, Beverly Hills. Israel is waiting, calling, needs you. And Baruch Hashem, can't be negative, many of these people, their own children, their own grandchildren are here. And you see what's going on. The airport was closed. People couldn't get in. First-degree relatives. We have so many first-degree relatives living here. So many of my friends have split families, partially here, partially there. Not simple. You have two children here, two children there. But Baruch Hashem, look at the positive. Look what we achieve. Now, one other problem that may arise, and it's a problem that is all over the place. I just finished one book and I'm reading another book, and my daughter gave me a third book on the problem. Tell me, are we a Jewish state or a democratic state? All right? I said it and will continue to say it. There is a basic contradiction between a Jewish Zionist state and a Western democratic one. The Arabs, who threaten by their very numbers a Jewish state, must be transferred out of the country. This is Jewish halacha. This is sanity. If this be incitement, I challenge you to take me to court. That's Meir speaking before an American crowd. The Jewish agency wouldn't allow him to speak in a formal setting, and he wound up speaking in a non-formal setting. But what he's hit upon here, do you understand? The one little paragraph, this little paragraph, who does Israel belong to? Who does the state belong to? Can we have a Jewish state? The minute you have democracy, what does democracy mean? People vote. What does a Jewish state mean? God commanded Shabbat. God commanded Kashrut. God commanded Taharat Mishpacha. If we put it to a vote, we'll be voted out of existence. Of course the people would like to have an easy life without any restrictions. At least most of the people. The mob scene. But what do we have here? Democracy or Judaism? And you talk about Judaism, do the Arabs have a right to live here? Transfer them out? Where are you going to transfer them to? How are you going to transfer them? In Abu Ghosh, that's an Arab village which has always been pro-Israel, even back in 47, 48. So I remember when Meir spoke and his ideas became public here, and this idea became public, he said, well, Meir promised me from Abu Ghosh they'll transfer us in air-conditioned buses. He had a good sense of humor. But do we really have an obligation to transfer Arabs? Isn't there a concept of a ger toshav? We're not talking about criminals now. We're talking about Arabs. This is our big problem. How do we get Arabs to be happy to be citizens of the state of Israel, to recognize how much democracy they have here, how much freedom they have? There were kids from Syria that came over injured in the fighting, and we took them into our hospital. One of these teenage kids said, it's a dream here. He said, I don't think anyone realizes. He says, the Arabs have more freedom in Israel than in any Arab country. The kid said it. His life was threatened, and they had to tell him to shut up or they're going to kill him when he goes back to Syria. But these are real problems. And can you have a country today that's not democratic? Just think for a moment. We have to be governed. We don't have a Sanhedrin yet. We don't have Mashiach Tzidkenu. We don't have Malchut Beit David. Can you have a country? And I have to be honest with you, until I went to communist Russia, I always poke fun. Those of you who have studied sociology, Alexis de Tocqueville, does that name mean anything? That's the French political scientist who visited America right before the Civil War. And he wrote two volumes on democracy in America. And he criticized. And he has a critique that's worth reading. When Howie was in kindergarten, Dina, I don't know if you know this, Howie was in kindergarten, and it's a rainy winter, and then a beautiful spring day, and the teacher said, what should we do today? We'll go on an outing. Should we go to the library or the zoo? And they put it to a vote. And Howie was the only kid who voted to go to the library. And they laughed at him and made fun of him. That's democracy, right or wrong? No, think about it. These are real problems. But boy, when I went to Russia, and I saw where Yomo came from, and I saw the Getchkes on the wall, Yomo probably doesn't remember this. We have a God that sail halan beseta. We don't see Ribbono shel Olam. And there you saw on the walls, beautiful buildings, Lenin, Marx, Engels, like statues on the walls, like the buildings were given government money. The nicer the statues, the more money you get. Do you remember this, Yomo? Yes or no? Right? Yomo certifies the Rebbe is not making it up.
Every classroom had a picture of Lenin.
Every classroom had a picture of Lenin. Rabbi Twesky, Baruch Hashem, without Yomo, you wouldn't believe me. But there's Yomo certifying the Rebbe's word. Now, I have to tell you, these are real problems. Meir articulated them very nicely, a little too sharply. I wouldn't say, you're going to throw, how can you throw Arabs out, have lived here, are good people, decent people, pay taxes, upright people, have professions, work in the hospital, doctors, nurses, etc., etc. We have to accept the reality. The Arabs were here when we came. Some ran away, some did not. Those that say, the Arabs ran away and merits, you're taking all their money and their houses. And what about the 2 million Jews who lived in Arab countries? They ran away. What happened to all their property? Okay? What happened to the Indians in America? All right, now they're going to leave it to America now. They're going to wind up within our lifetime. Yet we'll see Congress will pass a law that everyone of Indian descent gets $1 million from the American government for the fact that Columbus persecuted you when he came to America. Go back to my shiur yesterday, knocking down the statue of Columbus. Wow. This is Meir. Now, I have more to do on Meir, because in Israel, he cited problems that are absolutely real. And you'll see next week will be very fascinating what happens with him and where he learns what Israel is all about in jail and the problems he articulates. And I'll mention my own theory that to a certain degree may have paved the way for Shas. You'll understand me next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. But this is Meir. It doesn't mean we have to agree with everything. But the man hit upon real problems, and he articulated it. Professional people who are running a government and trying to keep everyone calm were not happy with Meir. I can understand it. But on the other hand, if we care about Torah, these problems, how do we solve them? How do we begin? How do we take the bull by the horn? And God bless Rosh Yehudi and all that's happening. One of the alonim that the freebies they give out on Friday in the shuls. And before we came in Aliyah, Rabbi Tatz, I recall Rabbi Phil Tatz fondly, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha, he had lived in Israel for a while. So he told us, he was a congregant of mine in Maplewood, South Orange. There was a big nursing home nearby, which he was one of the owners. Rabbi Bergman was involved with Bernard Bergman, Mizrahi, etc. So he said to us, you're going in Aliyah, nothing is free in Israel. Even the calendar for the new year, in America, used to get benches from Manashevitz, calendars from every funeral chapel, right or wrong, and they say, everything in Israel, nothing is free. Today in Israel, it's unbelievable. I must have 10 calendars I got this year for nothing, with all the information and the Shkir and the Shabbos and the Motzai Shabbos and the Netzach Hamara and the Zricha. Wow. Not only that, every morning you get a newspaper of quality. Free of, my wife told me this morning, my daughter just up off Yisrael Hayom for today. Wow. Friday you get Basheva. 100 pages, sections, pages, free, chinam, ein kesef. What a world, what a world, how far we've come. And this is with everything. We have to be positive. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll get there. It's not Yemot HaMashiach yet. It's not Kol Banayach Limudei Hashem. But we're heading for Rov Banayach Limudei Hashem. So to reiterate, yeah, Reb Meir, very fascinating. How, Yombo, will you tell Barak that I'm very disappointed he's not here and that I spoke about what he told me and I hope I had the facts correct. How you can demonstrate against selling, I mean, it's beyond comprehension. Why you? And if they sold the book on Muhammad Ali or Muhammad X or Martin Luther King, they would demonstrate. All right, they're interested. I want to read about Muhammad Ali. It's, wow, okay. If I had time, Malcolm X, I read a book about him. Interesting, fascinating. But and to demonstrate. Then I want to add, you know, just something else, halacha. The book was written by Libby Kahana. Tell me, is Libby Kahana an almana or not? Isn't there a different way we have to treat an almana? I know when I learned in Lakewood, I wrote about this in Washington, and you don't need any footnotes. These eyes and this ear saw it, heard it. One Shabbos morning, they told Mrs. Berman, ran the kitchen, she was an almana, of German origins. They told her, we'll be in to eat, to have the food ready, Shabbos morning, 10:30. Whatever it was, the davening was rushed, took quicker. We reached, 104 students reached the dining room, 10:15. Mrs. Berman said, you told me 10:30. It will only be ready 10:30. And she refused to serve till 10:30. Well, Reb Aaron returned from Borough Park. He stayed Shabbos Sunday, Borough Park. Part of it was family, part of it was fundraising. Returned to the yeshiva Monday. A delegation of two or three of the top fellas went to Reb Aaron to complain. Reb Aaron, I see it before me, Reb Aaron sat, this was a converted house. He sat like in a little anteroom that was his office where he had a Schulzinger Schatz blue binding, the most expensive that Mr. Klein, Stephen Klein of Barton's, gave him. No one touched that Schatz. That was the Rosh Yeshiva Schatz. It always had to be in place with all the volumes. And they come out, and everyone jumped on, what is the Rosh Yeshiva? What did the Rosh Yeshiva say? The Rosh Yeshiva said, I quote word by word, to sein gerecht, you are absolutely right, aber ich kann tan garnisht. Garnisht kann ich tan, there's nothing I can do. Sie ist an almana. She's an almana. Quote, end quote. That's Reb Aaron Kotler. And you're demonstrating, Libby Kahana wrote a book, lost her husband, lost her son, lost her daughter-in-law. Ribbono shel Olam. I don't know what happened to YU, but that story, I hope it's a miyut shebemiyut and not a miyut hanikar. My dear students, this was Meir, part of his life, part of his great ideas, and part where the ideas hit a stone wall. In America, I would say Russian Jewry and JDL cover it. In Israel, he uncovered real problems, problems that we live with and intend to solve until this very day. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, I hope to finish Meir, and from there we move in to a very fascinating personality, the Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis. She was very special. And I think to a certain degree she also changed the world. Today in Israel, who are the greatest preachers? The women. No one equals the famous women who are the greatest preachers. And I hope they realize they all owe a debt of gratitude to Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis. I want to say something about a sefer that was given to me, a gift by one of my Talmidim listening in the Five Towns, David Safir. And I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed this sefer. Tzidkut stands forever. The life and lessons of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Peer. Do you, any name that mean anything to you? South Ozone Park, rabbi, decades. He was a contemporary of Rabbi Isaac Tendler. He was a musmach of the yeshiva, YU. He and Rabbi Tendler are machatanim. And this book was written by his son, who I understand is a machanech, Rabbi Yechiel Peer. It's not a scholarly volume, don't misunderstand me. It doesn't give background and place and time. And it talks about South Ozone Park until today. I don't know where South Ozone Park is, okay? Explain to me where, boundaries, all right, there. Evidently it's someplace in Queens near Brooklyn, if I'm not mistaken. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I'll tell you what I love about the sefer. It's a son writing about the father, and the father's rabbinate. And I hate to say it, I recognized myself, my years in the rabbinate. I thought exactly as Rav Menachem Peer. His whole dedication was make every Jew a little bit more religious. What were some of his great accomplishments? He got Jews from the old country who had stores in America open on Shabbos. He got them not to smoke on Shabbos. They refused to close the stores, but he got them not to smoke. It was an overwhelming read, very simple read. It's not a heavy book to read, but wow. And some of these people, their grandchildren, total Shomrei Mitzvot, 100%, very moving. The only part of the book that shook me up was the son writes, and the son is a Lakewood graduate, and the son writes, he's discussing a halachic issue with his father, and they would debate, and his father happened to take the lenient view. He would often then say to me, quote, "What do you expect, Yechiel? You know that I'm a YU man," end quote. And the son writes, "I would wince at this joke, but then he would pause and his face would crinkle into a smile." How do you interpret that? The YU was the only game in town 100 years ago. Give YU credit, the ones who began it against all odds. And the father, what's wrong? YU, all right, you went to Lakewood. I would wince. And I have to tell you, YU today has also produced giants of Torah, giants of Yirat Shemayim, giants of Mesirat Nefesh, with all the problems. So all right, the freedom of choice, YU Lakewood. I wish I had a Perish Rashi on that passage. Are there any questions of the dear students in front of me? All right, I want to wish Howie and Diener a good trip back to Hollywood. Give my regards to all my friends that I miss you immensely. And I look forward to seeing more of Hollywood living in the woods of Israel than in the wilds of Florida. Yomo, can you open it to the world? Yomo. Are there any, 1 second, I'm asking Yomo, open it to the world. Yomo. To the Levensteins, you have regards from Larry Zeifman. Okay, is it open? Anyone have any questions?
Rabbi, I think yesterday you said Rabbi Yedidya Frankel was the father-in-law of Rav Goren.
The father-in-law of Rabbi Lau.
Nazir, the father-in-law?
Of Rabbi Lau. The father-in-law of Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau. If I said Rabbi Goren, it's a slip of the tongue. Okay? You got it? Rabbi Goren's father-in-law was the Nazir.
Right, Rabbi David Cohen.
Rabbi David Cohen, of course. But I thought I made clear it was Rabbi Lau, a Buchenwald survivor, etc. But it's possible. It's possible. The Rebbe also confused Lulav and Etro, Kibbutz v'Havdalah. Oh, Mark Wiener, the other Mark, says he heard Lau. So at least I'm in good company there.
Okay.
Yitzchak, what we spoke about with the vaccinations is very frightening. Mark and I are shaking because with the story that just happened that we know. On the other hand, you're dealing with percentages. If you're vaccinated, there's much less chance of dying. But there are instances where the vaccine alone brings about a terrible situation. I actually sent a letter to my doctor today. We need guidance, what we have to do, plain and simple. But the government has changed everything. I'm so confused, you have no idea. As much as I understand Shasim Paiskim to understand the government's new rules on the vaccine, I can't understand it. It's beyond me. But okay, maybe I'll get a Parish Rashi. Yes, Jack.
Can you hold up the book again so I get a picture of it? The book, because you... Wait.
One second, let me...
Okay, I was able to photograph it. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any more questions? Okay. I want to thank everyone for joining with me. And B'ezrat Hashem, until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya.